Good afternoon. It's so good to see each and every one of you here this evening. If you want to turn your Bibles over to the book of Nehemiah, that's where we're going to be studying from for a while as we continue our look at this book about rebuilding, a book about taking the projects that God has in our lives and working them to His glory. And we're going to continue looking on as we study through chapter 2. I want to remind us just a little bit before we begin of what we've seen in chapter 1. The message has come to Nehemiah, the reminder of what is going on in Jerusalem. He is talking to those who have come and told him about the reproach of the people, how the people are just, they're surviving. They're not even described as people that are really doing anything profitable. They're just hanging in there. They're just doing the best that they can. This news of the shape of the city, the shape of the people, it crushes him. And we talked about how that leads him to say this prayer that we begin reading in verse 4. And it ends with Nehemiah's request of God towards the end of chapter 1. He says, O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name. Make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. I was cupbearer to the king. And that kind of sets up chapter 2 for us, where we're getting ready to go in and see the progression of this story that is beginning to take place in front of us of Nehemiah's interaction with the people of Jerusalem, the king of Assyria, and all of this that's going on, and how God is working behind all of it and working through all of it for His glory. And so, you would join in with me, and let's open our Bibles to chapter 2, and just slowly, I want to take a look at each one of these verses in particular and kind of see what's going on. Try to open our eyes and picture this is what's going on in Nehemiah's life. And so let's just look at the first two verses together real quick. Verses 1 and 2, and it came about in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it to the king. And now I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart. Then I was very much afraid. And so, as we mentioned last time, we talked about this, our story takes place far from where we expect a story of the Bible to take place. We are no longer in Jerusalem. This is the time that the children of Israel, specifically the southern kingdom of Judah, has been taken off into captivity, and some of them have returned. Some of them came back with names go out of my head, right as I get ready to say them. So, Zerubbabel, some of them come back with Zerubbabel, and they've begun rebuilding the temple, and they've faced some trouble along the way, and now you have Nehemiah in Susa, the capital of the Assyrian nation, the Babylonian nation, and he is getting ready to approach the king, as we've just read. Now, I want you to think about a few things about what we're going to see in all of this. Number one, that's a great deal of distance. He's talking about something that's not in his back door. He's talking about something that's far away. This is a journey. In fact, if you were to cut a straight line from Jerusalem to Susa, or to Shushan, however your Bible translates that, you're looking at just about 750 miles. Problem is, there's a whole lot of desert in between there. And also, he's going to have to get supplies to do what he's hoping to do. And so we're going to see this journey probably take him other places before he goes. He's got a lot of things in front of him. A lot of distance, a lot of things that separate him from the project at hand, from the thing that is so close to his heart. But the chiefest of those at this moment, the chiefest thing standing in his way is not the distance, is not what's going to face him in Jerusalem. It's not the uncertainty, but the king. The king that he now stands before. And in his approach to the king, we see a few things. Number one, we started off last time talking about the timestamp. We see that we were in the month of Chislev when all this happens. And now we are in the month of Nisan. That is roughly about a four-month period. Nearly a four-month time span in our idea of time that has passed. And what has he been doing during this time? He's been praying. He's been praying over what's going to happen, what he's going to face. He's been sorrowing over the shape of the nation. He is so sad about all of this stuff, but he's giving it to God. And what's fascinating to me in all of this is while he's destroyed by that, he's heartbroken by that, it hasn't spilled out into the life around him. As we read in this section, the king says he is sad, and he had never been sad before him. And that tells me something about Nehemiah's grief, and it tells me something about Nehemiah's prayers. Jesus says later on to his disciples, when you pray, don't pray as the Pharisees pray. Don't pray in the streets to be seen by men. Nehemiah's prayers, not even the fasting that is going on with this, he's not doing this to be seen by men. He's not doing this so the king will see his sorrow. He's doing this so the king, so God will see the heart that he has towards this project. But now that has come to a point where it's consuming him. It's overflowing into his life. And he's now standing before the king. He is sorrow of heart. And it says that he became dreadfully afraid. You ever wonder why that is? Why was Nehemiah so afraid to be afraid or to be sorrowed in front of the king, I should say? As many kings in this time, as you would imagine that royalty today, they expect their presence to bring nothing but joy. How can you come into my presence, the most powerful man in the world, and have anything but just overflowing joy, to have the privilege to be in my presence, and you come in and here and you're sad, and that is an insult to me, and that is it tells me that you don't think highly enough of me when you come in here, that you're not just filled with exuberance. And so what is this? Why are you sad in my sight? Nehemiah probably was wondering what was going to follow that statement up. This can be nothing. The king says this could be nothing but sadness of heart. Is he going to follow this up with guards? Come take him away? Throw him in prison? Kill him? How dare you come before me sorrowing? He has to be wondering, what on earth, how is this going to go? Where is this going to lead? But I want you to remember, all of this moment is built upon months of prayer, months of just constantly pushing this before God. God, please grant me mercy. God, please be favorable to me. And so he uses the opportunity he has. Verse 3, he responds, I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tomb, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? I think Nehemiah, he makes this phrase here. The king says, why are you sad, Nehemiah? This can only be sadness of heart. What's going on? And Nehemiah's response to that is, let the king live forever. I bet those words have rolled off of Nehemiah's tongues 100 times. But I want you to stop and think about the wisdom in his response. He knows who this guy is. He also knows, we saw in the last chapter, that authority does not, or you know, it doesn't live in the king. Artaxerxes doesn't hold all the authority in the world. God is the one that I need to fear. God is the one that is going to be the power behind this. But I still need to know who I'm talking to. And he shows respect and he shows wisdom in noticing the king's stature in his request. But I want you to also know, I don't think he's trying to sell him on anything. I don't think he's trying to sweet talk him. I think he just sees the king for who he is. This is a powerful man. And this is someone who can do something to assist this situation. And so really what he's doing is he's saying, Artaxerxes, let me invite you into my world. Artaxerxes has asked him, what's going on? He says, let me show you the problem. Let me invite you into what I am dealing with. And too often, I think we fail to see that aspect of Nehemiah here, and we fail to see it in our own lives. We want to try to dress up the gospel. We want to try to show it in such a way that we can sell it to somebody. We've got to get them to buy in. When really, if we take a play from Nehemiah's book here and just invite them to be as invested as we are, invite them to see the problem. Invite them to see the solution. Invite them to make a choice to join in to the work of God. That's what he's doing here. This isn't a carrot on a stick trying to say, here, let's come out here and find this enticing thing. He says, let me just show you what I'm dealing with. The city, the place of my father's tombs, it lies desolate. The gates are consumed by fire. He says, this is why I'm sad. What I know as a home, what is special to my people, what is special to our way of life and to our God, it's destroyed. And Artaxerxes is going to understand that. As a king who is building an empire, he's going to understand what cities and what the gate to the city represents and what the wall of the city represents. He's going to understand the grace. He's going to understand the lack of security. He's going to understand where all of this is coming from and why this is hard for Nehemiah. He didn't have to be told how disgraceful the state of affairs was in Jerusalem because he understands those things. And now he sees Nehemiah's heart. Nehemiah has completely opened himself up, revealed himself to the king. He said, "This is what is bringing my sorrow, the dignity, the safety, the well-being of my people." And so he makes a request to him. In verse 4, the king says, "What would you request?" And so it says, "I prayed to the God of heaven. I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor before me, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it." Then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will your journey be? When will you return? So if it pleased the king to send me," and I gave him a definite time, and I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I've come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go." And the king granted them to me because the good hand of God was on me. And so he makes this request to him. And what stands out to me at the beginning of this, one of my favorite things about Nehemiah, is verse 4 in Nehemiah's prayer. It says, in just these short little words, king says, "Nehemiah, you've got my attention. You're sorrow. Why are you sorrow?" "Well, here's why I'm sorrow, king. Let me show you the problem. This is what's facing me. This is what I'm dealing with. This is what has broken my heart." King says, "Okay, I understand. What do you need?" And his first response to that is to pray. And I imagine that was not some great big, "Hey, king, I'll be right back. Let me go over here. Let me find these. Let me pray towards the temple. Let me do this." I imagine that was a very quick, "Here I go. God, please be with me. God, please have favor on me." As he ends it, "God, please have your good hand upon me, because I'm getting ready to do this thing. I'm getting ready to step into this, and I'm going to lay it out there for him." And he does. He lays out his plan. He is prepared for this moment. He is prepared for what needs to happen. That's the next thing that stands out to me in this passage is Nehemiah. He has been thinking about this, but not just thinking about it like, "Oh, how terrible it is that Jerusalem is in this shape." It is what can be done, and praying. And how can we do, how can we get this done? And praying, and fasting, and weeping, and more. If I had the opportunity, what would I do? And now the opportunity has been placed in front of him, and he once more goes before God and says, "Please be with me," and then I'm ready to go. I'm ready to lay out this plan. And once again, we see a lesson that we can learn today. We see a way that we can take that in our own lives. How often are we not prepared? Are we not ready to lay out the problem for someone else, especially the problem of sin in their life? How often do somebody maybe make that opportunity available to us, and we say, "Oh, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. I'll come back tomorrow. I'll try to deal with that then." It's so easy for us to see the problem in the world around us. It's so easy for us to see problems in our own life and not be prepared to be to be what's needed to meet those problems. Nehemiah, he has been thinking about this and focusing upon this, and he is ready. And so when the king says, "What is your request?" he says, "This is my request. My vision that I am revealing to you is that the problem, I want to fix it. The walls have been torn down. The gates have been burned. I want to rebuild them." It's a huge job in front of him. And it's a big goal. But Nehemiah is letting him know, I'm not just going on a fact-finding expedition. I'm not just going out here to see how bad it really is to check things up. I want to fix what is going on. It's also interesting, Nehemiah does not say the people of Jerusalem have messed up. He doesn't say anything about how, "Here's the problem, king. These people of mine went back to Jerusalem and did a terrible job." He says, "There's a problem. I want to be a part of the solution." That's it. I'm not going to drag anything else into this. I'm not going to try to his answers are positive. Constantly, his answers are, I see a solution. I know how we can fix this. And so he's enthusiastic about it. The king seems to be enthusiastic about it. Okay, let's do this. How can I support you, Nehemiah? Give me a time. And this capable leader says, I've got a plan, and I've been preparing for it for months, and so I can give you a time. And the king now is on board, and we're going forward with it. And now Nehemiah makes requests of the king, and he is bold. I want you to think about this Nehemiah who is afraid a moment ago, who is saddened, and he is now afraid of what's going to happen, and he prays to God, and now he's standing before the king, and he's saying, all right, king, this is what I want you to do. If it pleases you, give me letters, and I want you to give me timber, and I want you to finance this project. That's what he's asking him to do. And it's not because he wants to take advantage of the king. I don't think that for a second. I don't think Nehemiah has pulled the wool over the king's eyes. Again, he's not trying to sell him anything. This isn't any snake oil going on. He says, I want you to be a part of this too, king. I want you to join me in the glorious work that we have in rebuilding the city of God and in rebuilding its walls. He is showing honor to the king. He is showing respect to the king. He is inviting him in to participate in something that he sees worthy. And he knows the king has the ability. He knows the king is not only able, but it seems like he has sensed now the king is willing. And so you know what? If he's got the ability and he's willing, let's go. Let's do this. Let's work together. And let's see where willing hearts can lead us. And so it says, the king granted them these things, but I want you to think about how it ends. Verse 8 ends with this awesome statement. The king granted these things because the good hand of God was upon me. Over and over again, we're going to see that in this book. Nehemiah is never, never confused where his good favor comes from. Never looks at this and goes, boy, sure was lucky that the king helped out. Sure was lucky that the king did these things. I must have been a smooth talker to get the king to... He says, it was the hand of God upon me. A pagan king. Nehemiah looks at that and says, you know what? God can do mighty things. This person that I think many of us would look at and go, there's no way on earth Artaxerxes, king of empires that are conquering the world, that have taken, the Israelites have gone into captivity to these nations. Persia. I think I said Assyria and Babylon both already in this lesson. King of Persia. No way that king is going to do anything to help this project. Nehemiah looks at him and says, God can do far more than I can comprehend. God can do something with this situation. So he invites the king in. And now he has got the blessing of the king. So what does he do next? He does what makes a leader truly a leader. He doesn't just see the problem. He doesn't just try to source help. He says, it's time to get involved. You've seen those pictures before of teams working together, and you've got the leader. The one that always comes to mind is guys, they're carrying this heavy stone, and the leader is standing on top of the stone going, this way, that's where we need to take this stone. He says, that's not leadership. The next cartoon is the leader standing with the guys, his hand on the stone going, that's the way we're going, let's go. And he's in the back, and he's instructing them and helping them along the way. Nehemiah is that kind of leader. He says, I see the problem, I see a solution, and I'm about to get involved. Verse 9 says, then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. And when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. Those first words in verse 9, then I came. Nehemiah saw the problem and got up and started acting upon it. Just another example of his godly leadership. And as we talked about before in our map, talking great distances, great things stand in front of him. And he says, I am going to go. I'm going to travel the nearly 900 miles from Persia to Jerusalem. And I'm going to begin the work of rebuilding the walls and rebuilding the people and rebuilding the hearts and turning this thing back into something that is God glorifying. How many times do we have a heart that says, things need to change? I don't like what I see. This is not glorifying to God. This is shameful. We should turn these things around in our families, in our lives, in our friendships, even in our churches. We need to fix this and we're broken about it, it never leads us to move. We stop short of actually going out and doing what needs to be done for the goal to become a reality. Nehemiah shows us that it's one thing to have a heart to want to see the change. It's a completely another thing to take the steps away from where we are to start making that change a reality. We're also in this section introduced to these two figures, Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite. As he comes into the land, we're introduced to him like we should already know who they are. And we're going to get to know them much better as we go throughout this book. But the thing that stands out right off the bat is these guys are going to be enemies. These guys are going to stand opposed. They were very displeased that someone would come. They are very displeased that someone is seeking the welfare of the children of Israel. One thing that doesn't seem to bother them, doesn't seem to bother them that the temple is there. In fact, we're going to find later, there's some connections there with them in the temple. That doesn't seem to bother them. What seems to bother them is someone is coming to try and restore some sense of glory to the city, to restore security, to restore protection. And I think they are an absolutely wonderful picture of the workings of Satan in our life. Because the worship going on there, that didn't seem to bother them. They didn't seem to mind that worship was going on because that can be corrupted and that can still not lead to a people rebuilt. Again, Nehemiah is not just a book about a wall. It's a book about people being rebuilt to God. And it doesn't seem to bother them at all that the temple is there. But when we start talking about people being finding security again, people finding protection, the things that God offers us in our life, Satan does not want that. He would not mind all day long for everybody in the world to find themselves in a church building as long as I can keep them insecure, as long as I can keep them afraid, as long as I can keep them in some ashamed and unglorified position. But when someone begins to care about their well-being, when someone begins to care about the sad situation that was taking place here, the enemies of God said, we have to do something. And they are very displeased. These guys, Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite, their backgrounds, we really don't know just a terrible amount of detail about them. The Ammonites were offspring of Lot and his youngest daughter. You'll remember that relationship. They got his daughter, their father drunk and they lay with him, and this people became the offspring of that. They lived near Moab, and it's very likely these are people that were displaced at some time in the future by the children of Israel. The tribes of Gad, Reuben, and half of Manasseh. They were the ones that settled this pre-Jordan land that was once occupied by the Ammonites. And the Horonites are even more shrouded in mystery when we begin to consider who these people are. It's likely that they may as well have also been from the land of Moab, but it's also possible they were from the land of Beth Horon, maybe where they get their names, the Horonites. This is described in Joshua 16, and what's interesting is they too are people who would have had land that was now occupied or had been occupied by the children of Israel. In fact, the land of Beth Horon was occupied by the Ephraimites and the other half of the tribe of Manasseh. And so these two people, whoever they are, whatever they represent, what they want is a weak and a vulnerable Jerusalem. As long as the people of God are not strong, as long as the people of God are not secure, as long as there is conflict and there's stress in that situation, then they're happy. That's what we want. And so we keep that tucked in the back of our mind. This is our introduction to them, and we're going to come back to them. But what I want to see next is Nehemiah. He's made the trip there. He's come, and what does he do when he gets to the land? He begins inspecting the walls. It says, I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days, and I arose in the night, and I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the Dragon's Well and on the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I returned the valley gate again and returned. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. So Nehemiah spends these 3 days. He gets to the city, he spends 3 days there, and then he arises at night to sneak out and to go see what's going on at this on these walls. Let's get a better picture of the project that's in front of us. And I kind of wonder, I can't help but think to myself, had he rode into town announcing, here I am, we're going to rebuild the walls, we're going to fix all this stuff, we're going to get it done, what kind of discouragement might have met him? What kind of people might he encounter? The kind of people I think he would have encountered were the kind of people that said, we've tried that before. Been there, done that. We have the t-shirt. It didn't work out. It wasn't enjoyable. Our enemies just came out of everywhere. We're not doing that again. That's not what he does. Nehemiah knows, I need to understand this situation better than I do now. I need to see it further. You know, I've seen it from 900 miles away. I need to see it up close. I need to see what's going on. And I need to be careful about who I involve right off the bat. So he goes in and he goes out by the valley gate. And he sets out on the west side of the city and he just kind of circles it. Counterclockwise goes around and he looks at the rubble and he looks at the ruin and he looks at everything that has to happen. And he comes back. And after he's inspected all of this, he's seen the broken down gates. He's seen the walls and where it's been consumed by fire. And it says that he viewed all of it. That's an interesting word, in my opinion, that he viewed the gates. Because in Hebrew, it doesn't mean he looked at them. It doesn't mean that he just walked around and like a tourist, look at that. That looks pretty bad. No, the Hebrew word viewed means examine, but in a medical sense. When I think about it, the way we would examine a wound, someone has had this terrible gash in their hand, and we're like, all right, what do we need to do? We need to take a closer look. Is there anything in there? Do we need to get objects out of that wound and we're going to have to bandage it up? Or does that need stitches? Like, we need to take a closer look at this. He examined, as in, I want to heal what's going on here, but I need a closer look. He examined the wall. And for the first time now, for his own eyes and his own life, he is truly seeing the extent of the problem in front of him. I have traveled 900 miles. I have gotten here. Things don't look good. And I wonder how tempting it was for him to go, I don't know if this can be fixed. I mean, this is some real problems. And I know there's already people right off the bat. You have Sambalat and you have Tobiah and you have people that are frustrated and are displeased. But that takes us to Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 and 16. Randy read for us. And I took a gamble on having that verse read, because there is only one translation that says what I wanted to say, and that's the New King James and the King James. Every other translation changes this passage, but the New King James says that we are to walk circumspectly. That is an awesome word. I love the word circumspectly. So when we think of that, I was like, what are you saying to us, Paul, in Ephesians? What are you saying when you say walk circumspectly? Well, from circumspectly, means circular, circumference, circumnavigate an island. It means to just go around and see something from every single angle. We're inspecting it from the front and the back and left and right. We're going up high. We're getting close. We're moving around. We're going to look at every possible angle of this problem. And that is what we see Nehemiah doing. He is walking circumspectly around the problem that is Jerusalem. It says, this is a problem in the life of God's people, and it needs a closer look. And I think that attitude is going to rub off on people later. Maybe when the word is read, and they begin to see more problems in their life, and they said, we need to walk circumspectly again and look at the problems more closely. So Nehemiah knew the job, it's rebuilding the walls, but it's not going to move forward unless I see how truly bad the situation is. But again, I have to look at that and say how hard it must be to fight the urge to just say, this is tough. But you know what? What's going on here? What's going on here is sacrifice is happening. The temple, it's open. People are bringing their sacrifices in. Worship is occurring. You know what? Let's just see how things go. Let's just take our time here. We don't need to get out of hand. Let's try to stay positive and look at the good things. And sometimes I think we deceive ourselves when we just go, I'm only going to look at the good things. I'm going to walk around this city and I'm going to see some really bad things. But instead of focusing on those, I'm just going to keep looking over the wall to the temple and go, the temple is there. They're working in that. Let's just focus on that. We deceive ourselves when we don't see the trouble that is sometimes right there in our lives. Now, some people don't have a problem with that. Some people can only see the trouble. They're just full of criticism. But Nehemiah teaches us this example of examining the broken down parts of our lives and studying it. What's wrong? What's really going on here? And if we have the right heart and with prayer and with vision and with compassion, we can be used by God to set things right. That's what we're seeing in the example of Nehemiah. We're not seeing sideline critics. There are too many people who just want to sit back and Monday morning quarterback. They want to be the backseat driver and say, this is what's wrong, and this is how you're doing it wrong, and this is how you need to fix it. That's not what we see in Nehemiah. Nehemiah doesn't want to sit on the peripheral and go, I'm going to go and I'm going to preach to everybody all the things that are wrong. He says, I want to be involved. I want to be a part of the solution. And so we shouldn't hide our eyes from the broken down places. We should also not hide our hands from the work that is right in front of us. God's kingdom is full of positions for workers, for laborers to be used. And so Nehemiah continues. Verse 17, let's go on. Then I said to them, you see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. And they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. You know, another thing that just always pops out to me in this section is him meeting with these leaders, and he says, look at the bad situation we are in. Nehemiah's just been here a week, tops. I mean, if we're being liberal with our time, he's been here this very short period of time. I'm not responsible for this. I've been over here doing my job in Susa. You're the guys that have been here. You should have been rebuilding the wall. Nehemiah shows up. He doesn't say, look what you've done. Look how you failed. He says, look at where we are. I'm a part of you too. I'm here and there's a problem. What are we going to do about it? Such a fascinating thing. And what he does in that is he accomplishes, in my count, at least four things. Four things that just stand out in this statement of the bad situation we are in. Number one, he points out the obvious. And sometimes that just needs to be done. Sometimes people live with broken walls for so long in their lives, they don't see the broken walls anymore. He just points it out and says, guys, things are not okay. This is not how things should be. Sometimes that's the obvious thing is the hardest thing for us to see. And he invites us, just look around Jerusalem, guys. This is the bad situation that we are in. But the next thing he does is he doesn't admit that he's going to be the fix. I'm not the super builder that's come in. He says, we are in this problem. He owns the problem as not only as his own, but also as something that we're going to have to do together. He says, I can't do this by myself. This is a problem that you and I are in, so you and I are going to have to be a part of the solution. You're going to have to partner with me, just like he did with the king. Inviting the king to be a part of this, he's inviting the people, partner with me in the job of restoring Jerusalem and rebuilding its walls. And he brings this all around with the fourth thing, and that is there's going to be an end result. That is, we're not going to be a reproach. We're not going to be an insult. We're not going to be a mockery anymore. And that right there should tell us something. That should tell us that this is not about brick and mortar. This is not about beam and iron. This is not about walls and gates. This is about removing conditions upon the people of God. This is about removing shame and fear from their lives. About replacing poverty and insecurity with wealth and with protection. This is about hard work that has real spiritual impact in the lives of the individuals and the community of Jerusalem. And Nehemiah addresses any fears that they may have going into this. Here's the problem we are in. We need to work to this so that we will no longer be a reproach. And I need you to know that this has been going on for a long time, and the hand of my God has been favorable to me. So once again, Nehemiah, showing great humility, he doesn't show up and say, this is what I think we should do, and this is how we're going to get it done. And if we have to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, it's going to happen. He says, God is behind this. God is leading us. He says, I told them of the king's words that he had spoken to me. He says, God is guiding me through this. God was with me when I spoke with the king. The king now is on board. That's not because of me. That's not because I'm some great speaker. God's fingerprints are all over this project. And Nehemiah invites them to join. And once more, I feel it necessary to point out, even again, Nehemiah still is not selling anybody. He's not trying to hoodoo anybody into doing this. He didn't beg them and he didn't make deals with them. He doesn't go in there and say, for every person, for every 100 feet of wall that you build, you get a week's stay in the by the Sea of Galilee. I'm going to make sure that the king provides you with something nice. He doesn't do anything to try to convince them of this other than to say, this is God's project. And it's a real problem. But we can fix it. We know there's a job to be done. God is leading us to get it done. So let's get it done. And the response to that by the leaders of Jerusalem was to say, Nehemiah, we're with you. Let us arise and build. And again, I think of the ways they could have responded. Nehemiah, we've tried. We don't need the walls. We've been getting by this long. We're surviving. We've survived without those walls for nearly 100 years. We have a temple. Let's just keep getting along. They could have said, Nehemiah, did you see all the work when you were walking around? Maybe you should do it again in the daylight. There is a lot to be done. They might have said, Nehemiah, have you not met Sanballat and Tobiah yet? There are real enemies to this work. No, what they said was, Nehemiah, let's get it done. And immediately, opposition arises. Verse 19. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, "What is it? What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" And so we get introduced to our enemies again. And you know, things have been going extraordinarily well in this chapter. And it starts off, oh man, there's a lot of fear. Nehemiah's going for the king. But from then on, it's like a snowball of success. We are moving. We're in Jerusalem. We're ready to build. The people are behind us. And these guys show up. We should not be surprised that these guys show up. We should not be surprised that when the people of God put their hearts to glorifying Him, Satan says, I need to show up too. It's time for me to try to do something to derail this. Sanballat, the Horonite, Tobiah, the Ammonite, they come and they oppose the work. Now, Tobiah is a Jewish name. And we find him later connected. Nehemiah 13, verse 4 tells us he is associated with the high priest family. He is helping and getting help from the priests himself. In fact, his name Tobiah means Yahweh is good. What a strange name for someone who is so vividly opposed to the good name of Yahweh being glorified in his city. And then we have Sanballat, again, tied to the temple. He is connected to the priests through marriage. He's protected, connected to priestly families. And what's the weapon that they use starting off? They use mockery. It says they mocked us, they despised us, they used scorn in their attacks. They wanted Nehemiah, they wanted the people of Israel, the people of God here, to feel stupid. They wanted them to feel foolish. They wanted them to feel unequipped for the challenge in front of them, and they wanted them to feel afraid. But they're belittling, but in their attempts to belittle Nehemiah, we need to see that that's not who they're really belittling at all. Everything that they're doing, their scorn, their mockery, it's placed flatly against God. And when we allow people like that to take our hope away from us, children, when you face that, when you're in your schools and when you're with your friends and when you're around others and they think that you are just silly, how can you possibly believe this? How can you? Why don't you talk like me? Why don't you act like me? What I want you to know is that when they're mocking you, if that is happening, that is not an attack on you. That is an attack on your God. And your God is bigger than that. He laughs at the foolish plans that man makes against him. And Nehemiah fully understands that. This isn't an attack on us. But then, and I want you to show how they have no idea what they're talking about. Because they go on, they say, are you going to do this against the king? Number one, no, because the king sent me down here. The king is the one that has written me letters to come down here. The king is the one paying for this trip. So you don't know what you're talking about. And so oftentimes, whenever somebody is mocking us, whenever somebody is trying to belittle us, we need to remember that, that they're not belittling me, they're belittling God. But number two, they don't really know what they're talking about. They don't really understand. Because if they did, there wouldn't be a second that they would try to stand opposed to my God. They are ignorant. That's not an insult. That means they are without knowledge of what is really going on. And Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, they are ignorant of who the real king is. They're also ignorant of the fact that the earthly king has joined in with this. But I want you to see Nehemiah's answer, how he responds to that. Verse 20. So I answered them and said to them, "The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem." So notice how he answered them. We've already said, they're not mocking Nehemiah. They're not mocking the children of God. They're really mocking God. They have no knowledge of the truth here. Nehemiah doesn't go, "Here's the letter from the king." Because he doesn't need that. And they don't need that. He says, "I'll tell you by whose authority I do these things. I'll tell you where my power and where our favor and where our success comes from. And it's not from Artaxerxes. It's from our God. You can say what you want to, but we're going to work and we're going to finish this. We're going to do what we've set out to build. We're going to glorify God in our lives. But as for you, you have no right, no portion, no memorial." He proclaimed the truth about his enemies and he sizes them up. And he does so quickly. It is so hard for us to do that sometimes. Sometimes our enemies stand before us and we just magnify them. They get so big, and I don't know how I'm ever going to overcome that. Nehemiah sees right through it. "You are my enemy, but you are nothing compared to my God. I don't have to be afraid of you." But not only does he size them up, he knows exactly who they are. "You're not with us. You're not for Jerusalem. You're not for God. And you may think that you have a right to be here." As I said before, they're tied to the priestly family. "You may think you have a right to be here, but in reality, you don't even have a right to be a part of this congregation. You don't have a right to be in our midst." And it reminds me of John the Baptist when he talks to the Pharisees and he says, "Serpents, you snakes, who told you to repent?" But I want you to listen to his answer as he goes on. As he continues, he responds to them with this, I can't help but just find this so humorous. He says, "Don't even give me the line about Abraham's children. I'm sick of hearing about how you're Abraham's children. These rocks on the ground could be better Abraham's children than you. Don't give me that old line about being a child of Abraham. Because you'd have no right to the inheritance that I'm looking towards. You have no right because your heart is far from God." And what's interesting then is that the opposition to God, the opposition that stands in front of us, it doesn't have any power. It doesn't have any rights. It doesn't have any hope. But we also need to know that it doesn't usually go away. They didn't just hear these words from Nehemiah and go, oh no, we have no hope. Let's give up. And I would wish that they did. I would wish that that was true in our lives. But over and over again, these two are going to show up again and again, and their attacks are going to vary, and they're going to become more confrontational, and they're even going to become physical. They are not going to stop trying to oppose the work that was going to be done. But that's the fact that is so amazing about the book of Nehemiah. The work is going to be done. Just because opposition didn't stop doesn't mean that God's people ever stopped. They didn't let it affect them. They got the work done because God's good hand was upon them, and they proved their opposition completely wrong. Now that's Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2 is about a man whose eyes are open to the problems around him, whose heart is given to trusting and being devoted to his God, and who refuses to be discouraged, to be turned away by anyone that stands against him. And what I want to do this afternoon is I want to invite you to look into your lives, to look and see the projects that are in front of us, projects in our families and in our friends, projects within our church, projects within our own souls. What is broken down? What needs to be repaired? What is not glorifying to God? Maybe you've tried to fix that before. Maybe you've looked at it and you've said, I know this needs to be fixed. This isn't what God would want. And you've tried and opposition has arisen against you and you've failed. Maybe you've been mocked. Maybe it's been difficult and you felt like you've done this on your own. But what I want you to remember is this. I want you to remember the God of heaven will give us success. The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we His servants will arise and we will build. Can we build together? Can we assist you this evening in beginning the project of building up the wall in your life to bring the security, to bring the blessings, to bring the peace from God that will glorify Him and that will provide you with right and with portion in His heavenly city? Can we help you to begin that work? Can we help you to continue that work? If so, please come forward right now. Let's talk about that together as we stand and sing the song of encouragement.